Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. This week, we reach beyond our studios and bring you interviews from Wyoming PBS's Wyoming Chronicle. We check in with an author who wrote a book about the history of Wyoming and its role in the American West. It partially focuses on Jim Bridger.
In those 50 years for Wyoming, he was guiding people across the immigrant trail. He was assisting the Shoshone in getting weapons to defend themselves.
And a Wyomingite has a unique talent. Jack Mees creates miniature versions of familiar but much larger objects.
So I made an anvil, and after I made it, I got to thinking, well, why not make the tools to go with it? And I did that, and then it just kind of gravitated into.
Join us for those stories on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
And we are pleased to be joined on this Wyoming Chronicle with Wyoming author Sam Leitner, Jr. Sam, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Craig.
Sam, your book about Wyoming's history is just wonderful. And I want to get to that in just a moment, but I want to learn a little bit about you first. You're pretty much a lifelong Wyoming resident. Is that accurate?
I consider myself a resident lifelong. There were times when I was abroad. But I grew up in a place that used to be called Jackson. That place is kind of not there anymore. It's a different place now, but I grew up in Jackson. And at an early age, I got into climbing with a friend who lives in Jackson still, Mark Newcomb. And his dad taught us how to climb. And climbing ended up really taking over my life. So, you know, we climbed in the Tetons, but then when I got older, I made sure I was at the University of Vidavu, otherwise known as the University of Wyoming. And then I've lived in a couple other places. I lived in Banff for a while. I lived in Southern Thailand for a while. I even did a stint in Moab, Utah, all around climbing. And so I can't say that consistently I have been in Wyoming for that entire time, but Wyoming has always been my home. My family's still here, so.
And one of the great beauties of your book, in my eyes, is not only Jackson do you talk about in its infancy, you talk about Wyoming in its infancy, and I'm talking geologically. And I think maybe that's where I'd like to start with the book, The Wyoming, A History of the American West. Why the book, Sam? Why did you decide to write this book?
You know, I love history. I read nothing but history pretty much. If I'm reading a novel, it's either because someone I know wrote it or because it's related to some historical event that I want to know more about. And I've just always been fascinated with our history. I got the idea from a friend in Montana who was telling me, you know, there was this book written about all 53 or 56, I think it's called 56 is the name of the book. It's about different counties there. And I thought, huh, I could do a 23 for Wyoming. And as I started to work on it, I was like, no, what we've got to do is actually make a fun read out of Wyoming's history, because it's not just Wyoming's history. You go looking into Wyoming's history, you're learning the Western United States history, because things either took place in Wyoming and had an effect on the states all around us, or those things on those other states had an effect on Wyoming. So I don't know.
I can't overstate what I perceive this book will become, Sam, and that's going to be one of the definitive works truly about Wyoming's history. Not only, as we said earlier, from the early formations of it geologically, but every other great story that some of us may have heard a little something about and already forgot, you cover in your book. And I'm curious, how do you think this book will be used? It's such a great work.
I would like this to be, you know, there's a couple other history books on Wyoming, and they're valuable and they're very important for historians because they're very detailed. I would like this to be the general history book that people go to and go, okay, I know who Cattle Kate was because I read this. I know why John Coulter was in Wyoming. I know what the Teapot Dome scandal is now. All of these things that make up our history, I tried to pick not only the most entertaining stories, but also the ones that had the biggest influence on the rest of the country or that had an influence on the world. You know, Wyoming horses in World War I. Little things like that they could all be their own book, but to me, they felt like they were important enough for a Wyoming citizen to be able to say, well, I know about that, and this is why Wyoming is important in the world.
How would you classify your writing style? How is it that you perceive that you tell the story?
The hardest line to write in any book is the very first one, because you think you got to get it all correct. And I rewrite everything. But what I start out as is writing in my external voice. I write the exact same way that I would tell you the story. And then I have to come back and correct all the grammar or at least attempt to correct all the grammar. I usually have people helping me out with that. But I have to write the way I speak. And so I think that comes across as being a storyteller. And most of us can tell stories very well. You just have to get comfortable with the idea you're going to write it down. And then you go back and you fix it.
When did you start work on this book? And I ask it in the context really of Jackson, when you go back and you recount an interview you had with Cliff Hansen back in the days prior to the formation and talking about the history of how Grand Teton National Park came to be. But goodness, that was a long time ago, and yet it's included in the book. How long have you been working on this thing?
I did a book called, it's a roadside history of Jackson. And that was, I think, I was getting to interview all these older folks that you know, I'd always looked up to them and known they'd had this place in history, but, you know, I learned a whole different thing about them. But I started my research then, but I could also say that, you know, I started research on this with Mr. Parrott's history class back in the eighth grade, when we had 6 weeks of Wyoming history too. So, you know, if you're into history and you are from Wyoming, you're going to know about a lot of these things, and you're going to know not details, but you're going to know the basics of looking into the immigrant trail, looking into Red Cloud's War, so forth. You're going to know that those things are there.
You discuss the interaction of the Native Americans and the white tribe, as you describe them, as well as anyone that I've ever read. That's such an interesting part of Wyoming's history that I think people understand a little about today. Would you agree?
I do think that it's not that well understood. I think we tend to trend towards black and white and not see all the gray that comes into history. And then Hollywood hasn't done us any favors with, you know, the John Wayne approach, which I love John Wayne, but that's not necessarily how history took place. And the interesting thing about our history with the indigenous tribes, the white tribe history moving in with these other tribes, is also the time frame in United States history. The Civil War had an enormous amount to do with how that took place. And disease had a huge amount to do with how that took place. It's a very complicated history. It's not real simple of, all right, we're just coming in and we're taking your land. It was a lot more going on.
And you describe all of those things that you talked about just in such good detail and very well. You, I've got to ask, there are so many, you cover every character that I could think of, you know, from mountain men to the railroad and well beyond. And those of us who live in Fremont I used to live in Fremont County, you still do. You know, we know maybe a little bit more about the mountain men part of our history and fur trading and that era. But do you have a favorite character of all of those that you talked about in that era that you appreciate? And I think I know the answer to this question.
It's Bridger.
Yeah.
It's Bridger. And I said somewhere in the book, as an aside, I went out of the narrative and said in the author's eye, if, you know, in the naming of Wyoming, if Wyoming was going to get the proper name for what's taken place in its history, we would either be the state of Bridger or the state of Washakie.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit more about that, because that's certainly on my list of things to ask you about. Those of us who are vaguely familiar with how Wyoming was named, it was an Ohio congressman who happened to be born in the Wyoming Valley in Pennsylvania and thought that would be a cool name, and later on had second thoughts about that, as I've come to learn. But you make a great case on why those two individuals were really worthy, perhaps, of having this state named after them. Let's talk about Jim Bridger first and the qualities you perceived in him.
He came out, you know, as a kid. He was probably 18, maybe 17 when he came west. I believe it was with Ashley's group, the Hugh Glass incident and all that sort of stuff. That all took place when he was a kid, but he stayed west. And when other trappers were moving on, you know, when the trapping era ended and they moved on to Oregon or they moved back east, he stayed here and went into the next era, which was the immigrant era. And he married into the indigenous people. And he really became, for a very long time, you know, 50 years of his life, integral in those 50 years for Wyoming. He was guiding people across the immigrant trail. He was assisting the Shoshone in getting weapons to defend themselves. He also giving them ideas on, well, this is how the Great Father might react to that and so forth. So he was a part of things all the way through his life until he actually had to leave the state and be cared for back east. He was just a fundamental part of it in that era.
And you talk about his character.
He stood for what he believed in. He didn't back down. He tried to be a good man at all times. And obviously we can point to that first big event that the Hugh Glass incident and he and another trapper abandoning Hugh Glass because they think he's going to die. And they think they're about to get attacked by, I believe it was the Arikara. He felt horrible about it, but he was a kid at the time and was kind of taking orders from somebody else. And even Hugh Glass later met him and said, "Oh, you were just a kid. You didn't know." So he was an honorable man, I believe.
As was Chief Washakie.
And Chief Washakie for sure was. Chief Washakie was known, he was a badass. He was a tough guy who was known to be the one you didn't want to engage with. The other tribes knew you didn't want to wind up fighting him when things went to hand-to-hand combat in the fights between the Crow and the Shoshone or the Lakota and the Shoshone. You didn't want to mess with him. And he understood basic, basic tactics too. However, he was real quick to go to the peace pipe. And in Wyoming's case, he was a very wise man in going, you know what? We're sort of caught between a number of tribes here. And this white tribe's the new one. I think our best bet is to side with them, because otherwise we're already being picked on by the Lakota. We've already got a war going on with the Crow right now. Let's side with these guys. And he worked very hard to have a peaceful way through things when it was a very disruptive time for his people. And the obvious choice for a warrior was to go to war. He chose, no, we're not going to do that. That's not going to be our way.
Sam, in your book, you don't shy away from tough, tragic events. What happened at Crow Heart Butte was on that list.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing that the two chiefs did decide to, you know, Big Robber and Washakie said, this is not, you know, after 3 or 4 days of fighting, they said, this is just killing our young men. Let's two old guys go out and settle this. And it's, I think, there's no written of this, but when you look into how things took place, apparently Big Robber was mocking Washakie during that fighting where the young men were dying, was saying, why don't you get out and fight yourself? And Washakie was sort of directing things. And so then when this happens, Washakie knows he's a very good hand-to-hand guy. And Big Robber gets called out, says, why don't you, Washakie says, why don't you fight me and we'll just decide it on our own. And now Big Robert's been mocking him for days. I haven't seen where someone said, yeah, he didn't want to do it, but I would not be surprised if Big Robert was saying, oh, I shouldn't have been saying all these bad things all this time.
Well, and that certainly then influenced the history then of the Crow and the Shoshone, and I guess you could say ultimately the Arapaho tribes, which you talk about as well, very candidly. I don't know where to stop talking with you here, Sammy. There's so much in this book. Again, it's just starts with the formation of the state through present day nearly and everything in between. Sam, you talk about writing that first sentence of a book and the difficulty in doing that sometimes. The cover, in my eyes, also must be right up there with the difficult choices on how you're presenting the book to someone who's going to see it for the first time. What went into the development of this cover of this book? You choose a buffalo, you choose the train. What went into it?
My friend Brendan Weaver, who works here for Maven Outdoors, he's an artist and a graphic designer type guy. And when he found out I was working on this, Brendan's originally from Newcastle, and he's lived multiple places in the state. He played for the Cowboys, played football for the Cowboys. He's a Wyoming boy if there ever was one. And he just said, I'd really like to be able to get a shot at designing the cover. Now, I hadn't even thought about who was going to do the cover at that point. So I was like, great. Yeah, sure. Do it. And he played with me for a while I did it too. He was going to read the whole book and he kept telling me, nah, I haven't gotten around to it. No, I don't know. And then all of a sudden he's like, no, I read the thing like a month and a half ago. Here's what I've got. And he breaks out the stuff that he's got. And I was like, wow, you've hit it out of the park. I mean, you've got the traditional colors. You've got the two things that are, major components of our history. It's got a Wyoming, I was like, what font is he going to choose to put the word Wyoming on there? He used a license plate. It was brilliant. And I don't think you could have gone with Random House's best printer and they wouldn't have come up with a better cover.
I need to give credit where credit's due. I actually saw Brendan's post on Facebook about your book, and that was my first notice of what you had done. So thanks to Brendan from my end as well. I want to talk to you a little bit about what you're doing today. You're a climber and you're a writer, or you're a writer and you're a climber. Where does that work?
I'm a writer after I'm a climber, because that's how the order of things came. I never went into being a writer because I had this strong internal thing that said, I want to be a writer. I got into being a writer because I was a climber and I had this great adventure, this great climbing adventure. And I said, I got to write this down. This was too cool. And it wound up becoming an article in a magazine. And all of a sudden I realized, okay, it appears you've got a talent for doing that. So that can be the other thing you do besides climb. But I was definitely a climber first. And my life has revolved around climbing, and I would not be a writer if I hadn't been a climber.
You have several first ascents to your name. You also have spent a great deal of time in the Lander area recently, making sure old routes are now safe again today. What is it that you're hoping to do?
Well, so the most common form of climbing, the most popular form, really what's brought rock climbing out to be an international sport that's commonly done around the world, is what we call sport climbing. And that involves fixed anchors that are in certain spots in the cliff that are your safety equipment. And the first ones we put in 30 years ago have worn out. They weren't out of the best materials. It was far more of a crazy sport back then. There weren't standards. The standards have come way up in the last 20 years as far as quality, and the equipment has gotten smaller and less unsightly. So my goal has been to replace the old wearing out stuff, but replace it with that which doesn't bother the non-climbing public.
Your book previous to Wyoming, A History of the American West, was Heavy Green. You spent some time in Thailand. You present this fascinating book on a portion of Vietnam's history from both sides. How did your time in overseas influence how you wrote that book?
I have met people from both sides. I've got a close friend that lives over in Asia who is a Vietnam vet on the American side, and I've had Vietnam War vet friends who were from Laos and from Vietnam. So I've heard both aspects, and that was part of the reason why I wanted to do that book.
Do you climb and write in the same day? Do you have days set aside for writing, days set aside for climbing, or you kind of wake up and go with the flow?
It's usually one or the other. I have a hard time with the writing without warming up my mind. I can't have a lot of outside audio sources going on, and I can't have a plan to do something else that day. So I've got to just sort of focus on it in the morning and get my mind around it, and then I can stay focused on it. And the climbing, that usually requires some driving and warming up the body and so forth. So that takes all day too. So it's one or the other.
You've written, I think, 9 books. Am I right about that? Is that the correct number today with the newest here?
I think that's the number that are published. I have 2 that I didn't publish. One was just both of them were they didn't quite have a market, and so but they were fun to write.
You know, really, I've thought about your book as a possible use, maybe as a travelogue. I mean, you talk about so many people in the book, and someone goes by Walcott Junction. Oh, okay. Yeah, and you know, the Bridger Valley, for crying out loud. I mean, the references are all over Wyoming Ames Monument. I mean, you could just go on and on. And your book provides context for all of that. So really, you've done the heavy lifting in my eyes, almost.
Yeah, I think, yeah. I mean, a lot of the research has been done on doing sort of an audio version of a roadside history. You know, I've got the knowledge somewhat in my head and definitely have the notes for most of it. But putting it in that different format and laying it out in a linear highway version, that'll take some work, but I think it'd be a fun project.
Jack Meese makes miniatures, anvils, firearms, cookware, even a steam engine. His tiny letter-perfect replica of a 19th-century ranch wagon has been shown in museums. He had no model for it, no instructions, no pictures, just measurements and memory. It took 2,000 hours to complete. Every facet of the wagon copies the real thing, including the invisible inner workings of the hubs and brakes, details that no one else will ever see. When he learned that the original full-sized wagons were built with 48 carriage bolts apiece, Jack looked for them in the minuscule size he needed. He couldn't find any, so he made the bolts himself, including the threading and the nuts. And when he couldn't find tools precise enough to make those Lilliputian bolts, he made those too. Such is the talent and the precision, such is the dedication and the patience, such is the world of 91-year-old Jack Meese.
There's almost nothing you can't build. Is that safe to say?
People say, is there anything you can't make? And I say, money.
Wyoming Chronicle met Jack a few days before Christmas inside his shop between Hudson and Lander. It's an unforgettable workspace, jam-packed with materials, tools, machinery, books, pictures, workbenches, and example after example of his astounding finished creations.
The building we're in now, which is a spectacular shop in its way. It's not the fanciest place, it's not the biggest, it's not the shiniest, but you use the heck out of it, don't you?
Oh yes, yeah. My wife and I built the shop. We didn't do the block work, but we did put on the roof and then finish the interior and so forth.
There's this wagon, which I think is in the shot that we're looking at now. Equipment like that, smaller things, there's a stove, you have knives, you have tiny anvils. I can't even begin to name it all. How long have you been creating these things, since you were a young man, I presume.
I started making knives the first thing that I did, and of course they was rather crude, as anybody would, beginners would be, but I graduated doing a little finer work.
How about the these miniature or scale model, scaled down objects that you made? What's the, can you remember the first one of those that you did, or the first type of thing you started doing?
I had a friend named Don Layton, a real good machinist, and he made a miniature anvil, and I saw it, and I thought, well, I can do that. So I made an anvil, and after I made it, I got to thinking, well, why not make the tools to go with it? And I did that, and then it just kind of gravitated into.
Let's talk about if you're making an anvil. It's only about this big. What does it start with?
Just a piece of steel. Just a block of steel.
Mm-hmm.
What's funny, a lot of people said, ain't that hard to make? And I said, oh, heck no. I just cut away everything that don't look like an anvil.
Just leave the anvil
there.
Yeah. When you say you cut away, you're using a machine.
Yes, a milling machine.
Look at this. Just incredibly precise.
Yeah.
Now, did you do your scale, your studying of a full-size anvil, even for something like this?
Well, anvils, they was all different sizes
sure.
of anvils. I mean, yeah. They were sold by the pound, I think. But there was no real, they was more or less shaped the same, but they could be a lot of different sizes.
Yeah.
I make them, the blocks kind of the scale, like 5 to 1, but you figure the anvil and the length of the horn, the height and all that. Blacksmith was working at the anvil. Top of the anvil would come right to where my knuckles is right here.
Yeah.
That, and then it was shaped where it was kind of sloped away from him. When he hit a piece of red hot metal, the sparks would fly away from him.
Mm-hmm.
And the farrier never discussed, told his helper, it's so noisy in that shop, if he wanted him to do a certain thing. He'd hit the anvil with his hammer, and a certain tap would mean to do this and do that.
So signal him that way.
Yeah, it was.
So if we blew this up to this big, it would be proportional and
yes.
functional. And
yeah, yeah.
That's, you make a point of that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a toy, it's a miniature. Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
Jack, I don't think anything demonstrates what I'm going to just go ahead and call your mastery of your craft and your art better than this, or even as well as this wagon does. You told me you had an estimate of how many hours you had into it.
I'm estimating at least 2,000 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just by figuring up how long it took to make, say, one wheel, how much time it took to make each carriage bolt and the spokes and so on and so forth. And like I say, 48 carriage bolts at 30 minutes per bolt, not counting the nut.
And we're not even looking at those. I mean,
And then let's say it's 15 minutes per spoke, 48 of those. Mm-hmm. Then you have to make the hub, which is rather involved to make all of the cuts into the for the spokes to fit into the hub. And the bands on the hubs, I took old shock absorbers and would turn them down, and then I'd heat them on my stove and press them on that hub so they'd shrink to fit, more or less.
Wow.
Same with the tires. Once I got the wheels shaped and ready to put the tire on, I'd put it on the stove and get it as hot as the top of the stove would get it. I'd put it on and beat it on real quick and then put it in water. And that's what they call shrink to fit tire on your wheel.
So these are, not only then are you conceiving of the scale and the materials, but then you're almost creating these techniques that you're using.
As close-up videography reveals his meticulous craftsmanship, Jack fills in some of the details.
So you, including what you made was this nut.
Yeah.
The threads.
Square nuts, everything in them days was square nuts, and I had to thread it and make the squared part on the head of the carriage bolt where it wouldn't turn in the wood when you tighten the nut. And I think it averaged 30 minutes per bolt, not counting the nut.
I would think at least that. Just remarkable. Once you made them, you used them.
Yes.
You didn't make them just for the fun of it. You made them because that's what holds the thing together.
Yes. And like I say, every piece on here, the tires, I had to make the tires out of a piece of pipe and turn them to size. Same way with the bands on the hub. I used old shock absorber tubes to make the different bands for the hubs, and of course I'd inlet all the hubs for the spokes. And there's six fellows. That's the wooden piece here. There's six fellows in here, and I had to inlet them so the spokes would go in. Once I had the wheel shaped and ready, I put this tire on my wood stove and get as hot as I could get it. And I'd pound it onto the wheel and then put it in water to cool it off right quick. So it's a kind of a shrink to fit. And this piece here where they put the foot was called a dashboard. You still got a dash in your car. Yeah.
I love these terms. And this is another part of what you learned.
Yes.
And you were interested in that too. What's this called? I want to use the right terminology as well. You developed then some tools for that you had to have so that you could make the wagon, and you have a couple of those here as well.
Yes, this is a tapered reamer for tapering the hub. Here's a partially made hub, but I had to drill a hole in the hub and then take tapered reamer and go in here and put the correct taper on that. And then you got a thimble that goes in that, so I had to make a reamer to taper the thimble. And then on this is the one for the thimble. This one here, out on the end of here is a metal piece on the axle that's called a skein. And I had to make a tapered reamer for the skein. And that's all on a taper. On the right side of the wagon, they had a right-hand thread. On the left-hand side, they had a left-hand thread.
And that's what this one has.
And as it's going forward, it's trying to tighten the nut on it. And this axles on the front axle was what they call a gather or toe-in. We call it toe-in. So as long as you're going forward, that wheel is trying to go close toward the center of the wagon. If a nut came off and you backed up for any distance, the wheel could fall off. Yeah. Or hit a rock, it would fall off. And this is shock absorber tube that I would turn down to press onto the little hub. And there's different sizes hub bands on that hub.
I just continue to be impressed by the idea that we're looking at that hub, no one was going to know that you'd actually threaded it the way that the wagon maker would have. Yeah. But you knew. You wanted to do it right.
Yeah. I'd get articles or whatever and what I needed to figure out how to make everything authentic. Yeah. I found books that explained it. Had a guy tell me one time, what I know, I didn't learn from no dang book. And I said, yeah, but how much do you know? I said, I thought that's what they made books for, is to teach us.
Now, also, because you're striving for authenticity, you built and created things that the owner, the operator of this wagon, would have had. And I'm going to show one of them here. He had an axe, would have had one. You made this.
Yes, yes.
In fact, there's your name on it. Meese Made, Lander, Wyoming, it says. It might have been a chuck wagon. They had to eat. So here's a little Dutch oven that you made as well, with the handle, with the lid that comes off. Beautiful, intricate stuff. You made a set of skillets and a plate, because that's what they would have had. You made a coffee pot with a lid.
Eight cups. I've got the cup there, and I measured it. It holds exactly eight cups. The old trail driver cowboys all carried 10 cups and so forth, and they would hang out on a saddle string on their saddle, and a lot of the times the handle would get broke off. So that's what happened to that cup. The handle got broke off.
You even authentically broke off the handle, but that would have happened. You know, I'd be hard-pressed to say what the most impressive part of it is, but this might be it. So included in the cook set that the wagon operator would have carried is this tiny, tiny set of silverware, knives, spatula. You told me to be careful with these, and I am. Forks. Yeah.
And the old-time forks was three-tine. They wasn't four-tine like the modern forks.
We'll just show the spoon because
the spoon is the hardest part to make.
I wondered about that.
It's not really a regular-shaped spoon. It's more like a gravy ladle or something on that order, but to make a spoon shape is
tough.
Yeah, I almost have to make a stamping mechanism to do that.
How in the world would you make something like that? What did you have to do?
Well, I just took a piece of metal and ground it down and shaped it and drilled holes in the handle. I had to drill the holes in the handle before I heat treated, because once you heat treated, you cannot drill the holes. The drill wouldn't drill it. But then I'd polish it back out, and then I put the handles on made out of micarta, and I could put the rivets on there, and it wouldn't split the micarta when I branded the rivet.
So you must have had to go to a manufacturer to find rivets this size, right?
No, I made them.
You made those?
Just out of wire, yeah.
But here's a rivet maker you were telling us about.
This is what I made, the rivets that goes in here on these standards. And if I make a rivet, I put a piece of baling wire in there, and one side has got a bigger hole in the top of it. I'd brad that and then push it back out of there, and I'd put that through from the wood side. And then on the metal side here, I could brad that, and it wouldn't split the wood.
You've always been just good at this kind of thing, good at picking it up?
Well, it seemed like that comes easy for me. I guess it's God-given, but I can sit down and think about something like that, and it forms in my mind, and I just go ahead and do it.
For the wagon, for example, did you have a model that you were working from,
a
picture?
No, I had a few pieces of a wagon in the backyard, but I just went around the country and would look at different wagons measure them and so forth. And, of course, there was no two wagons was alike, except even the factory wagons. Studebaker was one of the biggest wagon makers and one of the best wagon makers. Yeah. But John Deere made wagons, but there was a lot of individual wagon makers, so there was all types of. So but it's just, I'd measure this one and measure that one and come up with the formula I wanted.
So when I think about it, there's some mathematics involved in this too.
Oh, absolutely.
Measuring, making sure you get the scale,
which is crucial
to it.
Unless you're into it, you don't realize how complicated it is to just build a wheel. It's rather complicated till you get into it, you don't realize what is involved. And a lot of the hardware I made out of welding rod. Heat it and flatten it out and do whatever I needed to shape it to.
So when you flatten it out, I mean, so we're getting into kind of blacksmithing almost?
Blacksmithing, yes.
Another of your skills.
Yeah. The fifth wheel is all on, turns on metal, and that's all has to be specially shaped.
Mm-hmm. You found you liked doing this kind of thing.
Yes, I'd stay up till midnight a lot of times and get up and go to work 8 in the morning. Yeah.
What kind of work were you doing through
the
years?
I was working at U.S. Steel when I was making the wagon.
I see. Yeah. So it was a way for you to get away from that, to occupy your mind, occupy your hands, use your brain. You had the patience for it. That must be a huge part.
Yeah. For some reason, I can do that, but I can't sit out there and fish for 5 minutes if I don't get a bite.
Yeah.
And then this, if you can see here, this little, what they call stay chains, mm-hmm. I made all of those out of music wire.
You made the chains.
And I had to make a tool to make the chains, in which I got the tool here that I made the chains out of music wire. Once I wrapped them on there, and I'd cut them with a hacksaw blade, then put them together, and then weld them back together.
So link by link by link,
yeah,
you made the chain.
Yeah, and that was to keep, if you start a new horse and the old horse started and the young one didn't, you wouldn't pull a young horse back into the wagon. You can see the toolbox with some spare parts in there and the wrenches and so forth.
Spare parts, now come on.
New carriage bolts and other.
So this wrench has a function?
Oh, yes. Yeah, the wrenches fit all the nuts on the wagon here. Whatever nuts is on there, there's two or three wrenches in there. And I made all the wrenches, of course.
Of course.
Yeah.
Wow. How much trial and error do you go through?
You know, it's funny that I could just...
Not a lot.
I just do it and it worked. I don't know why. I've born, I guess, with a knack for doing that.
So the little knife handle and drilling the tiny little holes and making it flush, pretty well did it the first time.
Yeah. But it takes some thought, definitely takes some thought. It's like each piece of this seat has to be made just right, but... Like I said,
that's what you do.
It just isn't difficult for me to do. I actually rode in a wagon when I was a kid. Yeah. I had an aunt and uncle that they hauled our potatoes to town with one mule in a wagon. Hmm. Yeah, they just had, they had shafts. If they had one, they just had shafts instead of a tongue.
Yeah.
And it's amazing what that little old mule could pull up a hill. You'd think they couldn't, but it was astonishing what they could pull.
Through 9 decades of life, Jack rarely has encountered a construction task that his analytical mind and skilled hands couldn't handle. Metalwork, he can do it. Rawhide braiding, that's a specialty. Woodwork, auto mechanics, bladesmithing, yes, and yes. Blacksmithing, check. And add gunsmithing to that list as well. Another celebrated Meese-made creation is this miniature rifle, perfectly crafted and authentic inside and out, right down to the firing mechanism and ammunition.
Well, it's called a Remington Rolling Lock. Remington designed and manufactured these, and 17 foreign countries adapted this for their military firearm, this rolling block, and bought the rifles from Remington. But there was a collector from Laramie quite a few years back, I don't remember just what year it was, well, it was 98, I think, asked me if I'd make a miniature. He collected a rolling box. If I'd make a miniature, and I said, you want a Creedmoor? And he said, yeah. Well, all winter I made, worked on this, and I got it done. I took it over in the case and the whole bit and handed it to him, and he looked at it and said, how much? I said, $3,000. He handed it back, and I'm glad he did, because I've since turned down $5,000 for it.
Is that right?
But it's definitely one of a kind. Everything, this is long-range veneer sight that actually adjusts for height and so forth, and the windage is out on the front sight. There's a windage adjustment that moves it from side to side. And the reason it's called a rolling block is you pull a hammer back and you roll this block and it rolls. And that's, you load that and then you push your block back forward and it's ready to fire, and pull the trigger and it fires. And then I put it on safe cock. But everything on it is a replica of the 1874 Remington Creedmoor rifle. It's too small to physically shoot, but I did make a cartridge for it. And you can see the primer in there, see the little...
It's almost microscopic.
Yeah.
Do you work with a glass sometimes to...
No.
You don't?
I can't. I just...
You eyeball.
Glasses. I got 3-power glasses that I put on to do this kind of work, but I can't work under magnifying glass and do this kind of work.
But you said it will load and it will eject.
Yes, and there's a screw right there that holds that ejector in there. And this firing pin is spring loaded, and the firing pin is not much bigger than a needle.
Jack, you must be one of the most patient men alive in this setting. Do you think of yourself as that way? Are you a patient man and when you're not in the shop?
I can do this work, and if I make a mistake, I don't throw a tantrum. I just put it away and start over. And I learn, you actually learn more when you make a mistake than you do making something right.
Sure.
It's kind of hard to explain it that way, but it's the fact that you do.
Later, Jack points out this tiny replica of a steam engine he'd seen in Montana. After reading up on the mechanics of the invention, he built it to perfect miniaturized specifications, using only some Polaroid photographs for guidance. By the way, it works perfectly.
My daughter's got the big one in her yard in Montana, and it's an old antique, and some of the parts is missing off of it. And I was looking at that one day, and I thought, I wonder if I couldn't duplicate that thing. So I looked it over and studied it a little bit, and my son-in-law sent me photographs of it, and I duplicated it using photographs. I had to buy a book to study how the valves actually functioned. For some reason, I can sit down and think about that a little bit and decide how I'm going to go about it and do it, but the valves actually gave me trouble, and I bought the book and figured out how those were
working. You bought the book. When in doubt, buy the book.
Yep. But that was not really simple to do that, by no means. Them have to function perfectly. You can see the linkages in here, how they're all that's working. Steam was not simple. It was very complicated.
You work, I know, with other people. You invite them to come in and work with you. You teach them. You work beside them in the shop. you've done with people of all ages for different reasons.
The neighbor kids down here, I think one of them was 8 years old, and I was doing a little braiding, and they seen it, and then they got enthused about it.
Yeah.
So there was two of their kids that is the ones I really started teaching. I've had 6 grants from the Arts, Parks, and History to teach braiding. I've had over 70 people that started braiding, but most of them would last 2 or 3 weeks or something on that order. But I've had probably 10 that got fairly good at it. George is the last person that I had as a grant. George Kirst.
And you told me he's a cancer survivor who's been in here working with you here quietly for years.
Yes, he had. It was nip and tuck there for a while, I think, with him. He was at the Salt Lake, the cancer center down there. But he would come in here and get the braiding, and you could hear him humming and whistling occasionally. And so to me, and I know his wife really appreciates it, she said that's the best therapy that he could have possibly had. I had another guy, a good friend of mine, his wife passed away, and he didn't have things to do, and I suggested that he braided, and he started, and it was a lifesaver for him, too. Helped him get over it. Yeah. It's just something that they can do that makes them feel good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot of my students say they get all wrought up and out of sorts, and they can go and sit and braid a little while, an hour or two, and it's, this calms them right down.
Yeah.
If you got your hands busy, you're thinking about what you're doing instead of your problems.
Yeah. That's what it's been for you through the years?
Well, I don't say I had problems, but I've always been kind of nervous and keep doing something with my fingers and so forth, so it gives me something to do besides just play with my fingernails.
Yeah. Jack Meese, thanks for having us into your shop and into your world a little bit. I'm just feel greatly privileged to have seen what you do and heard about it, watch you demonstrate it, think about you in here doing this stuff. You told me you're 91 years old, and it's a remarkable thing to have done at any age. I'm really glad you're still doing it. I hope you keep on doing it for as long as you can. And thanks for being with us on Wyoming Chronicle.
Well, thank you for doing it.